Hello, and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Hannah White. So, the Rishi shuffle has taken place. Now what? Well, the names and faces look pretty much the same, but the signs on the door look quite different. Four new government departments were created this week as the Prime Minister redesigned the government to, in his words, reflect the priorities of the British people and deliver for them. So what changes has Sunak made and what impact will they have? We're going to dust down the IFG's manual for making a success of machinery of government changes, to use the technical term, and assess what pitfalls and opportunities await. We're going to take a look at the winners and losers in Sunak's new look government and what further changes may or may not yet follow. And we're going to ask what the government reshuffle means for Labour too. Lots to be getting on with then, and we've got a top IFG duo in the studio with me here today to discuss. Our Deputy Director, Emma Norris. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Hannah.
And Alex Thomas, Programme Director for all our civil service work. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Hannah.
And I'm absolutely delighted that we're joined today by Paul Waugh, Chief Political Correspondent at the I Paper and author of the essential War on Politics evening email. Hi, Paul.
Hi there.
Now, what did you make of this week's surprise in all of our calendars, the visit by President Zelensky to Westminster?
Well, it was quite extraordinary to be in Westminster Hall. You know, the word historic is totally overused in politics, but it genuinely did feel historic, him communicating so directly the sort of rawness of what it's like to be at war in Europe in the 21st century. And I thought that was quite a powerful address. Certainly, what I picked up most of all was just what a brilliant politician he was. He came with a series of, you know, he's got a big shopping list and he knows which buttons to press and how to try and build alliances to get what he wants. And I thought that was the most interesting thing about it of all. It wasn't just the props of the, you know, pilot's helmet, or as powerful as that was. It was more the fact that he was, in my mind, bidding quite high in the knowledge that he won't get everything he wants, but he will get some of the second and third order things he wants. And so away from the headlines, for example, it's not all about jets. It's really about long-range missiles and longer-range missiles. And only this morning in a number 10 briefing, they made quite clear they were very, very cagey about what that meant there, because the Prime Minister had said in his press conference, that we are open to more help with longer range missiles. When press, number 10 were incredibly cagey. When they do that, you know it's significant. And so what's going on there is part of a broader push from Zelensky to get the US and European allies to give him stuff that he needs now on the battlefield. And I thought that was, to my mind, the sort of slightly hidden story of yesterday.
Yeah, and I mean, first thing, for me, it reminded me of the excitement that will have been coursing through number 10 and the parliamentary authorities and stuff to have something like this happening. There's definitely kind of, you know, I happened to be walking around St. James's Park and saw the King on his way to the palace to, you know, presumably then meet Zelensky later. And there's this sort of energy that will have been coursing through Westminster that I'm sure Paul experienced. I wonder also if it might, in this sort of hyper-speed politics and government that we're in at the moment, it might draw Rishi Sunak towards the sort of comfort, if that's the right word, of foreign affairs even more quickly than previous prime ministers that we might have seen, given some of the challenges he's got at home and the difficulty that he'll have making progress on some of them. So I wonder if he might turn to the solace of foreign affairs even more quickly than a sort of Johnson or Cameron or Brown or even Blair.
I mean, personally, I think my overriding thought was how it put in perspective some of the sort of political shenanigans we've been putting up with in the UK in recent months and years. And, you know, here was a politician with a really serious agenda, which he's pursuing on behalf of his people. But let's get on to some of those political shenanigans that we've been experiencing this week. Of course, not just that, but also very serious thinking on the part of the government about how to organise itself most effectively to do its job. Paul, how long do you think this reshuffle that Rishi Sunak conducted this week has been being planned? And did it go according to plan?
I certainly think it's part of his original thinking during the Tory leadership campaign last year. Certainly the idea of a separate net zero department, which takes in the energy functions of BEIS, has long been an idea of his and the people around him. And I think certainly since the beginning of the new year, over Christmas, he was putting some serious thought into, you know, what does the shape of my Whitehall look like, or should it look like? And it came out of that. And now, obviously, what blew everything out of the water was Zahawi and subsequently Raab, which the latter is unresolved, of course. But it's part of his strategy of trying to say, look, I can run government well. And the whole of 2023 is all about delivery. So you've got his original five pledges, which are obviously, as you've discussed at great length before, most of which he could do without tripping up over his shoelaces very easily. Some things are going to be very hard in that list. But it's part of that. And the big question is, does this machinery of government stuff actually deflect from his main five targets? Do they muddy the waters somehow? I personally think actually they don't overall, because on balance, he's saying, look, I've got a vision for the future. And the vision is obviously the correct one, which is post-Brexit Britain, a post-Ukraine invasion Britain, needs to focus on energy security. It's very smart, in my opinion, to market net zero as energy security. That makes a lot of sense. Similarly smart to focus on science and digital, some of Britain's obvious opportunities going forward in a very competitive global marketplace. We do have some edges there. And similarly, the global edge we have in creative industries, it makes a lot of sense to strip down that department and take some of it out. So overall, I think the rationale makes a lot of sense, but as you guys on your own Twitter space of the day discussed, you know, the real problem is, you know, what instability does it inject into civil service? What delay does it inject in terms of the delivery when you've only got 18 months to go to prove to the voters you actually made a difference? So there are the downsides. I think overall it makes a lot of good strategic sense. My worry, I suppose, would be whether or not it's going to make any difference in terms of policy and on things like net zero. The jury's still a bit out.
Yeah, I was reflecting this week that, you know, there was a lot of commentary that, you know, there's danger of Rishi Sunak being too short term in the run up to the next election. And now he's possibly, you know, it's a positive sign for him that he's now being criticised for the opposite, possibly like taking too long term a view. Maybe that means he's kind of striking the right balance. But Emma, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the kind of initial commentary around the reshuffle and particularly the kind of the MOG changes was this surprise at the lack of obvious political benefit for Sunak. And I think there's actually a real danger that we talk a lot about the problems of short-termism in politics, and then we fail to value the long-term moves when they actually happen. And, you know, exactly as Paul has said, actually, it makes a lot of sense to connect net zero with energy security. And it's probably a change that we would see under Labour too. Lots of these departmental changes, I think, you know, it's possible they might have some benefit in the short term, but it's much more likely that they are part of, you know, a kind of positive long-term strategy. And I think we have to be quite careful that, you know, we do actually value that long-termism when it occurs.
Yeah, I mean, there is this slight thing going around that it's a very noble thing for the Prime Minister to have got government ready for Prime Minister Starmer when he comes in, which is a little bit glib, and we'll see what happens. But there's definitely something to that. I mean, we were talking at our annual conference a few weeks ago about making sure that 2023 isn't a wasted year for government reform, and this is sort of a piece with that. I mean, like Paul, I think there's quite a lot of sense to it. I think definitely an energy and net zero department. That's also a relatively low impact change. So we may talk in a minute about some of the costs of these things, as Paul hinted at. But energy and net zero is quite a discrete part of what used to be the BEIS, the business department. Similarly, linking business and trade, that's, you know, historically resonates, has been the case in the past, makes a lot of sense. I think might, you know, as well as reflecting the Prime Minister's priorities, these sorts of changes create their own kind of institutional momentum. And certainly we saw with the creation of the Department for International Trade, not just the career of Liz Truss, but the institutional momentum created then around trade deals, some of which might have been done in a little bit too much haste or perhaps without reckoning on some of the trade-offs. So linking the trade deals into the business department makes a lot of sense for me. The question for me, I don't disagree with creating this sort of science department in the middle, or science and technology and digital department. But that's the one I question its longevity. I question that will be quite an easy department to dismantle for future prime ministers or even this prime minister to tinker around with. Would it have been better to dock some of these science functions more closely into the centre of government, into number 10 in the cabinet office, and to get a really kind of clear line running through that than saying, oh, my priority is science and technology, let's create a department. So not sort of against that, but that's the one that creates the questions for me.
On the other hand, I mean, the digital part of DCMS had been getting pretty big, hadn't it? So, I mean, that would have been homeless in that situation.
Well, I guess you could have left it in DCMS or I mean, it has moved, again, it's moved around a lot already. I do feel, on a personal level, I feel sorry for some of the civil servants in DCMS who've made it a kind of project over the last 5 years to really build up the department, and actually on their own terms were doing, you know, fairly well. And to pull that out again, you know, them's the breaks. But DCMS, from having been growing into quite a big economic department, is now you know, the caricature Ministry of Fun. Again, a bit unfair to some extent, but DCMS will now sort of move down the Whitehall pecking order.
And Emma, Alex mentioned the costs. I mean, we've done work on machinery of government change in the past. There will be inevitably costs. The Prime Minister may well judge them worth paying.
I mean, as you said, I think there are financial costs. Then there's the kind of associated disruption. And on the financial costs, I mean, we looked at this a couple of years ago and, you know, thought that it costs about 15 million in kind of startup costs and then another about 35 million in terms of kind of, you know, productivity adjustments. So, you know, you're talking about 50 million per new department just in terms of getting started. You know, that's obviously a kind of cost worth thinking about. But I think the bigger issue is the kind of disruption that goes with machinery of government changes, kind of Alex has already alluded to. And, you know, the FCDO is still settling into, you know, the kind of DFID and FCO merger a couple of years later. You've got like practical things like setting up new IT systems, payroll, are something that's been talked about lots. Are IT systems compatible? You know, who's using Google Drive and who's using Teams and so on. But then I think you've got the really knotty set of issues, which are how do you maintain morale when you, you know, make and break departments at a time when morale, as our Whitehall Monitor report showed, is already really low in Whitehall? And how do you avoid machinery of government changes from being a you know, very costly distraction from the work that civil servants could be getting on with? How do you avoid them hugely damaging institutional memory? I mean, we are already seeing civil servants move between departments at much kind of higher degrees of turnover than normal. The same with ministers, by creating a whole load of new departments, new ministers in post, civil servants moving around. Are you actually damaging that institutional memory even more at a point when stability would be quite valuable?
So I think that's a really good point about the institutional memory, because, I mean, it's very fashionable in business and in politics, in every area of life, to talk about synergies, is to talk about efficiencies, talk about how you can have cross-government efficiency in many ways. Now, some of that obviously is worthwhile, but it's about time people stood up for silos and spoke in defence of silos, in my opinion. You don't get enough of that. Silos are actually really good because they have institutional memory. You give a bunch of people a task, they go get on with it, they build their relationships, and they prove effective, in my opinion. There is a real danger in too many of these changes in tearing that up. And I think some of the best governments have actually created departments right at the beginning, stuck with them, tried to keep the same Secretary of State, tried to keep the same ministerial team, and have a continuity and stability that builds on that institutional memory. And I don't know, I maybe I'm just slightly an outlier on this, but silos are good.
but you then need a strong sort of centre to join things up where they need to be joined up, I think, is the view. So I would tend to agree with you, Paul. And I think, you know, our colleague Giles Wilkes wrote a comment on our website, sort of not quite in defence of silos, but definitely saying Sunak seems to have chosen to take that approach to this reshuffle, which in these terms is a good thing. But government, you're always going to get fragmentation in government. So these machinery of government things, you know, in the end, it comes down to where you want the breaks to be and where you want the links to be. And different prime ministers might take a view on that, but there will always be tricky policies that cross those boundaries. And so you need a really strong function, well, in the centre or wherever, that can kind of break them down and force departments to work together.
I totally agree. But I also think in some policy areas, you just need some stability, and even a strong centre, you know, isn't going to deliver that. And I know that everybody has said this, but it is worth saying. housing. We are on our 15th housing minister since 2010. I mean, the lack of institutional memory and the lack of progress in that policy area, I mean, it really is scandalous. So I think, you know, let's hope that the 15th is going to stay for longer than a few months.
And that really gets Paul at the why the electorate ought to care about this. I mean, presumably the electorate won't really notice what's going on in terms of the shifting and making and breaking of departments in Whitehall. But what they might notice is progress or lack of it in different areas that they care about.
Yeah, ultimately, obviously, it's that knock-on effect on their real daily lives. And what that's why, you know, the whole question mark about whether this is going to improve or delay delivery really matters. I mean, politically speaking, I think what's interesting about the so-called reshuffle was that there were relatively few political changes. Lucy Fraser, quite well rated by civil servants and politicians alike, finally getting a proper cabinet job, so to speak. A lot of people welcome that. Grant Shapps, the fact that he got that new big Department of Energy Security reflects his own status within the party and within the government and how much the PM relies on him. Not just as a doer in the Michael Gove sense, but also as a media performer, very, very good at that. And I think that's got to be a plus for the government. Kemi Badenoch, I mean, getting that department, the opinion split as to whether it was a promotion or not. I mean, given that department really loses a big chunk of its firepower in losing energy, I'm not so sure it was a promotion. However, politically speaking, certainly gives her more profile, certainly gets people talking about her as a future Tory leader. She is certainly being touted as the sort of Michael Gove protege, the heir apparent for that bit of the Tory party, the people who like to sort of, the think tank world that actually treat her quite seriously. The jury's out personally on whether or not she's all that, to be frank. But there's certainly a strand of Tories who really do like her. And what I find interesting about that job is if I were her, my political tactic would to be to sort of go down the sort of extreme route of saying, well, you know, deregulation is everything. I'm the deregulation queen. Once I've done most of my deregulatory bits, and she may well suggest this, I'd really like to abolish my own department. Why should we have a department of business? It's not in tune with my strand of political thinking about how government works. It should get out of the way. And ultimately, I mean, I know this was flirted with in Thatcher's day, wasn't it, by Lord Young? You know, why do we need a department of trade and industry? That given that it's so slimmed down, maybe that might be a political ambition of hers. Who knows? The other politics of the reshuffle were interesting in that sense that they were the party stuff. They were Greg Hands basically being, effectively minister for the blue wall and Lee Anderson becoming minister for the red wall. And again, as we've seen overnight, I mean, that is fraught with difficulty, I think. To my mind, it just shows, it really exposes how hard it is to hold together that coalition built in 2019. And the lack of a leader who can do both jobs as Boris Johnson did. I think Rishi Sunak has divided that departmentally, so to speak, on the politics side of things. And I'm not quite sure that's going to work.
And I think, you know, on Lee Anderson, on the deputy chairman appointment, the risk is you can see what Sunak is trying to do, obviously, you know, trying to appeal to the red wall. But I think it was perhaps Sam Friedman who was saying that the danger is that on, for instance, the death penalty comments that are being reported today, the people who disagree with Anderson are repelled by the comments. And those who agree with them see Sunak distancing himself from those comments, making it clear that he doesn't agree with them, and they're disappointed too. So actually, whilst you're, you know, trying to make a smart political move in appointing Lee Anderson to that role, it's fraught with difficulty actually for Sunak, because it in some ways exposes the divide between him and, you know, somebody like Lee Anderson, who clearly holds quite different views to him.
And Alex, are you surprised that Sunak didn't wait for the Dominic Raab situation to be cleared up, or do you think that maybe this is the fact that he went ahead with this reshuffle before that had happened is an implicit sign of endorsement from the Prime Minister?
I don't think it's a sign of endorsement. I think we shouldn't read too much into that. Am I surprised? I think after the Nadim Zahawi process played out, albeit very quickly, but I think I'm not surprised that Dominic Raab remains in a job because this process is still continuing. So I think Rishi Sunak needs to kind of lean into being the process guy on this, on these kind of ethical questions. He did that with Nadim Zahawi, took a bit of flack for not acting sooner, maybe not asking Zahawi to step down before the ethics advisor reported, but in the end kind of stuck to the process. I think he'd risk creating more problems than he solved if he sacked Dominic Raab or did something similar to that before this Adam Tolley, senior lawyer, process concludes. So I would see those in fairly separate kind of boxes. I wouldn't be surprised though if there was a, you know, break glass in case of emergency, who should we make Lord Chancellor and Justice Secretary plan somewhere buried in a drawer in number 10.
Definitely. And I think it was pretty smart of him not to do anything about Raab before this machinery of government change too, because it would have obscured it completely. Imagine if he'd done all of this on the same day that Raab was forced out. All the headlines would have been about Raab. All the headlines would have been negative. And, you know, even promoting a new Tory chairman wouldn't have got any upside at all. And let alone all the good stuff about his long-term strategic vision for delivery by creating these new departments. So that would have all been blitzed if he'd waited for Raab and done it all at once, as some people suggested. I think, yeah, Alex is right. He has to follow through on his due process point there.
I agree with that. And also, I mean, one wider point on the reshuffle is people often talk about how difficult reshuffles are and how things might go wrong. They're an awful lot easier if you don't sack anybody. So the reason that the Prime Minister could tie this all up with a bow, announce it in one go, you know, do it in a morning, and then convene the cabinet straight afterwards, was because actually there weren't the difficult conversations, the trade-offs, the kind of, you know, agonising meetings going on for hours in number 10 where people are haggling over departments didn't need to happen because everyone, you know, everyone had a prize.
But Paul, do you think there are therefore the downside of that is that there are a set of people who are feeling now aggrieved that they weren't promoted because there were no gaps? So is there a generation of sort of rising stars who are now feeling a bit annoyed?
Not really. I mean, their time will come, but he's got to do something on that, I think. I suspect we'll have another, you know, I think the Raab changes might help someone else get a leg up, someone perhaps maybe from a more recent intake, and the knock-on effects on another bits of the reshuffle, the dominoes that will fall there. I do think that this isn't the end of his changes of ministerial ranks, though. I suspect we'll have another one in the autumn to refresh things. And certainly Labour, which we may talk about, have done the right thing in not reacting with their own reshuffle immediately, because I think Keir Starmer's got his own agenda there that he wants to do in his own time.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. Just before we do, Alex, it's not just ministerial personnel. With these new departments, we've had a lot of permanent secretaries moving around too, haven't we?
Well, yes. Paul did the sexy ministerial stuff. I'll do the bureaucrats. So, yes, we have had a perm sec reshuffle. This is a proper quality IFG content. So just to do the names and brief kind of pen portraits, at the Energy and Net Zero department, we've got Jeremy Pocklington, who's come from the Levelling Up department. That makes sense. Like I think a lot of these, there is quite a round peg and round hole thing going on with the perm secs. Jeremy Pocklington has worked in the field of energy before. He's experienced on that. That's an appointment that makes sense. The science, innovation and technology, we've got Sarah Mumby, who was the BEIS permanent secretary. So that's a sort of shift across. She's taking that bit of BEIS and going over. She was a civil servant a long time ago, then went out to the private sector, came back to be the permanent secretary at BEIS. In business and trade, Gareth Davis is the perm sec there. He had not even got his seat warm as permanent secretary at the Department for International Trade, but then again, it makes sense to keep him there. He'd only been in a month or so, so keep him there and do that. And then at the down culture, media and sport, and there's a job share. Polly Payne and Ruth Hannant are doing that on as interims, and the interesting thing about that is to note that if they applied for and got that job permanently, that would be the first ever permanent secretary job share, which I think would be another little milestone in terms terms of the modernisation of the civil service. And then the final point is that Sarah Healy, who had been at DCMS, gets a bigger job replacing Jeremy Pocklington at the Department of Levelling Up. So that's a slightly bigger job for Sarah. So churn in these jobs is not good. We generally would always argue to try and keep more stability in the system. But if you're going to make a change like this, you know, I can see the logic bit behind it. So yeah, inside a Whitehall bit over.
It's also the reuniting of Sarah Healy and Michael Gove, isn't it? She was his director of strategy in DfE, so it'll be interesting to see. Yeah,
and it's also a welcome relief that Sarah Healy, after that awful Oliver Dowden stuff about her Peloton use, has not harmed her progress, which is great. I have to say, look, maybe you can tell me a bit more insider intel, though, Alex. Is Sarah Mumby a science graduate, is my big question, because it's obvious Michelle Donnellan isn't. She's I think she was a politics graduate at York, wasn't she, which is not quite on brand for the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology.
Yes, you're putting me on the spot now. I'm frantically Googling and I'm going to fail to to do this. But she certainly, Sarah and I wouldn't remember this, but I think Sarah and I were fast streamers together in the Department for the Environment. And I think many years ago, and I think she was on a science stream there. So I have a hunch, but put it no more than that, that she has a scientific background. But we'll check and, no doubt.
She's an economist. As an economist.
I confuse my economist and my scientist.
The wrong science.
The dismal science.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, I want to end quickly by looking at Labour. Paul, you mentioned earlier that you thought it was wise that Labour hadn't rushed into a sort of parallel reshuffle. Is that you think they need to play the longer game?
Yeah, I mean, when you're in opposition, you can't be seen necessarily to react to everything the government does. And obviously, they're called shadow ministers for a reason, but there's lots of shadow ministers who don't have actual ministers. So at some point, Starmer is definitely going to get rid of his shadow minister for peace, for example, which is such a ludicrous hangover from the Corbyn years. Everyone knows that's going to go. He's already made some progress he scrapped the Cat Smith job, which was a shadow minister for the Constitution and something else, which was actually a cabinet ranking role, voter engagement, I think it was. So, but he needs to do more of that. Obviously, as Alex said, it is a big plus that Ed Miliband now finally has someone to properly shadow. But that shows in a way that Labour have been ahead of the game, or at least that big issue of policy. I think for Starmer, what he knows is that for members of the public, they don't notice cabinet changes, let alone shadow cabinet changes in terms of what that means for them. But it's much more about what are the round pegs in round holes going to look like when they're in government. And they're definitely, as you all know, gearing up for government in a big way. And he wants a team that's going to hit the ground running, and that means stripping out people who are not necessarily his political allies. He's got to keep some kind of political balance. You'll notice that in some junior ranks he still has some left wingers that perhaps he wouldn't normally want to have. You know, he's got his Rachel Hopkins, he's got his Nav Mishras, they're sort of part of the Angela Rayner deal. I suspect they'll all stay there because in various jobs, because he doesn't want a needless fight with the party over that. But I suspect you'll see the Starmer ruthlessness come out in his reshuffle, where perhaps even older friends of his may well sort of, who are not performing, maybe dispense with. I mean, you saw that in his previous run. You know, Nick Thomas Simmons, who was a very good ally of his, fellow lawyer, they think the same way on lots of things, was, if not demoted, at least sidelined, and ended up with his trade job. And, you know, the Welsh Secretary now, I mean, the various people who were close to him who got their jobs, that effectively moved them out a bit from the centre. So I think you'll see more Starmer ruthlessness, but just not yet.
Exactly. I think the big question is when is the Labour shuffle going to happen? I mean, people keep talking about, you know, kind of after the local election. So perhaps we'll see something later in May or in June. I mean, I think a couple of things came out of this reshuffle that Labour will be thinking about. And I think one is the kind of the respective relationships with business. I think there's definitely been some worry amongst the Conservatives that they're losing business support to Labour. Labour did, you know, their big kind of packed back in business conference in Canary Wharf at the end of last year, had lots of big names there. And I expect Sunak is going to be hoping that, you know, the merging of trade and business, the emphasis on science and innovation might start to turn some industry heads back towards the Conservatives. So Labour will no doubt be thinking of that. I think the other piece is it will start focusing Labour on what are the kind of machinery of government changes that they might be making. You know, we've already talked about the fact that the change to energy security and net zero is essentially probably in line with what Labour would have done. But I think it will raise other questions for Labour, not least, you know, Sunak did nothing to the centre of government. But I think it's fair to say that the centre of government has not been functioning at the top of its game in the last couple of years. So, you know, what's Labour thinking there? Are they going to be making any changes, creating special units, creating a department for the Prime Minister? Who knows? But I would expect they'll be thinking about that. And it will also be interesting to see what they do with the Department for Levelling Up. You know, Lisa Nandy's shadowing that brief at the moment. If she stays there after a Labour reshuffle, you know, will be anything be happening to that department? So, yeah, I think let's wait and see what Labour do on machinery of government.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think Emma points to a really interesting point, which is that the questions rightly that are usually put to the opposition in these kind of contexts is, you know, what are you going to do? And, you know, there's maybe the Labour do have quite a lot of policies. Maybe they need a slightly more kind of compelling message to put them in. You know, the how are you going to do it, given that Labour have this opportunity of 18 months before the next election to invest some real thinking time in how they want to run the government and to do it for a sort of five or even longer year period in office seems like a real opportunity that they want should grab by the neck. The other thing, this goes to what Paul was saying, it's just, you know, it's very interesting the state of the polls and particularly some extraordinary seat projections that, you know, may or may not happen, but if they do, would completely revolutionise politics at the moment, give Starmer enormous authority. So this is the moment to start making some of the changes that he wants to make, both in terms of personnel and structures. There are also, you know, there's a suggestion that he's appointing a new chief of staff who may come from government, come from the civil service. That would be an opportunity to really think about some of these kind of how things in quite a radical way as well.
And you didn't name names there, Alex, but obviously I don't know if Tom Scholar is genuinely interested or not, but if that were the case, then that would be an extraordinary move. And part of me thinks that some civil servants might slightly balk against that because it just going straight into a party job after such a long career of working for all parties might sort of just not sit well with some civil servants. I don't know. But I personally think that would be interesting, although a lot of people overdo just what that chief of staff role actually means. And, you know, Labour have been through a succession of people they thought would be good. I remember there was a Tim Livesey did it for Ed Miliband and he was a disaster. There's been a string of people who are just not up to it. So it's a very difficult job, that sort of Leo McGarry role. You need experience of Whitehall and of politics, and there's not many people who fit the bill. The one thing that I didn't mention is that in the short term, obviously departmental question time, it would be interesting to see Labour, the one slot they do have to fill is this DSI IT Shadow Secretary of State for that. And it'd be interesting to see, given how important science is historically to Labour, especially since the Wilson years, who they choose to do that. It's a really important job for Labour. And I don't know, normally you'd say it'd be someone like Liam Byrne, but obviously he's out of favour. So I don't know, a young, thrusting person, my tip, who'd be perfect for it, Darren Jones. Whether or not he would want it before, you know, when doing the shadow role, or whether he'd want it when they bring him in after an election, I don't know. But that guy's going places.
Yeah, he's certainly been tipped to be a mover in the shadow reshuffle. I think on that, just going back to your chief of staff point, Paul, I think what's really interesting about this appointment is that Labour have, you know, kind of publicly said that they were looking for a former civil servant to fill the role. And I think that tells you something about Starmer's approach to preparation for government. You know, they're clearly focused quite strongly on that if they're looking to take somebody who's, you know, been inside the machine recently to help them start preparing over the next kind of 12 months.
And that's obviously the sort of Jonathan Powell, Ed Llewellyn for Blair Blair and then Cameron model. They were both diplomats, which is interesting. You know, it's relatively unusual for a kind of in the machine civil servant to flip over for the reasons that Paul says. You know, it does sit slightly oddly, and for that reason, I have no inside knowledge, but I would be quite surprised if Tom Scholar did it. You never know. But I'd also say it's. I mean, we talked quite a lot about Dan Rosenfield, who was appointed as Boris Johnson's chief of staff, and at the time we said, you know, that there's a political gap there. You need to be a political operator. So even if it is an ex-civil servant, this is still a political role, and they need to be able to behave and have political antennae, even if they delegate, you know, quite a lot, or you know, the prime minister delegates quite a lot of the raw politics to somebody else.
And just to go back to something that Emma and Alex both mentioned, it's worth saying whoever wins the next election, the IFG is going to be doing a great deal of work between now and then to think about the centre of government and how to make that work better. So watch this space for more from the IFG there. Now, it's recess next week, but politics is showing no sign of slowing down. And at the IFG next Thursday, we're hosting Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, who will be giving a big speech on how the Home Office would work under a Labour government. Emma, are we seeing a gear shift in terms of policy offers from Labour?
I don't think we're seeing a gear shift quite yet, and I think some of it will wait until after the reshuffle we've been talking about. But I think we're starting to see, you know, kind of big, broad directions of travel. We had Starmer's start the year speech. We've had the Brown Commission. We know that they're, you know, really interested in kind of big picture health reform, you know, spreading power out. Lisa Nandy has talked a lot about her kind of decentralization agenda. I think the next step is, you know, really getting some of the meat on those bones. What are the actual policies they're proposing? I think the big picture vision is good, but quite soon the public are going to want to know exactly what it is Labour will offer if they go into government. And I think we'll be seeing that this year as we move towards party conference season.
And Alex, the next big date in the political calendar is the May elections. Are these actually a big deal? Don't we actually know quite a lot about what's going to happen in those already?
Well, I suppose it depends on what the result is, doesn't it? Is the flippant answer. But they could be quite a big deal. And obviously all of this chatter about Boris Johnson comebacks and all of that. So anything that destabilises Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister could end up being a big deal. Let's see how the expectations game is played. As ever with local elections, you need to look back to when the last set of locals was. And I think I'm right in saying these would be 2019, which, of course, was that year of ferment in British politics. If I remember rightly, I think Conservatives did badly in the kind of so-called blue wall and Labour did badly in the so-called red wall as a sort of prelude to the general election at the end of 2019. So one of the interesting things will be how the kind of expectations play and whether Sunak does, the Conservative Party does better or worse than expected. I would anticipate quite a lot of downplaying of the prospects for the Tory party in order to make any result seem sort of less damaging if it comes through and it's not a good one for them. So we'll see. I don't think it will affect politics that much other than in sort of the standing of the Prime Minister.
And I think let's all spare a thought for Greg Hand, newly in the party chairman role and having to be responsible for getting feet out on the streets campaigning for the local elections.
Well, that's it for today. Many thanks to Alex Thomas, Emma Norris, and especially to Paul Waugh. And thank you all for listening at home. Remember, you can find all our podcasts at iTunes, Spotify, and all major platforms. And do leave us a review or consider subscribing. Sign up to watch our Yvette Cooper event. Details are on our website. And do take a look back at all our fantastic reshuffle analysis. Parliament has risen for a half-term recess, and I hope you all enjoy a break if you have one lined up. But wherever you are, Inside Briefing will be back next week. See you then.